Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's start out by talking about bees and regenerative agriculture. Dr. John Lundgren is an agroecologist and entomologist. He joins us today to talk about the Blue Dasher Farm Initiative and a gathering on Monday, June 13th that's part of the National Keep the Hives Alive Tour. Dr. John Lundgren, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you're joining us from somewhere between Brant and Esteline, is that right?
Yep. Actually, right off of the freeway.
All right. Tell me what people don't understand about bees. Let's start there.
Well, I think that, number one, bees are so important in just about everything that you're eating. If you like fruits and vegetables, you can thank the honeybee. And the other thing that I think people are hearing about, but maybe haven't conceptualized in their own mind, is that the bees are facing a lot of challenges right now. But when you really look at the numbers, I mean, imagine a farmer losing 40% of his crop every year, or a rancher losing 40% of their herd. That's what we're expecting the beekeepers to experience on an annual basis. So we really need to do something about this.
So what's the history of this? How long has it been a problem, and how long has the bee population been in decline?
Well, the bees have been sort of every year you expect to see certain levels of decline within honeybee colonies. But the problem really became exacerbated around in the early 2000s. And that's when we started to hear the term colony collapse disorder start to get kicked around quite a bit. So.
And what does that mean, colony collapse disorder?
Well,
was that a new thing at the time? I mean, was it a new term that was coined?
It was, yeah. One of the members of the tour, David Hackenberg, out in Pennsylvania, actually coined that term. And it was a unique event in that we had not experienced hive losses at this level. You would normally expect to incur around 11% hive losses, and suddenly we were starting to see 30, 40, 50, 60% losses annually in our honeybee hives. And it's like, what is going on here? Hmm. And so a number of potential, you know, causes have been identified, be it pesticides or be it, you know, a lack of food for the bees. They need flowers in their environment. Maybe it's diseases or a pest called the varroa mite. But what we're trying to promote at Blue Dasher Farm is the fact that a lot of these issues that the bees are facing are intimately tied with our food production systems. Hmm. And just the simplification of landscapes that we've seen going on within the region.
So talk to me a little bit about food production. Do we have a tendency to sort of idealize it or romanticize it? Is it all science, or is it more simple than I might think?
Well, food production is, you know, the cropland around us or the ranches that are around us. And we've kind of gone down a road of large monocultures. And what we're trying to do, and there's consequences to that. There's benefits to that, but there's also a lot of consequences to that.
Tell me what it means first. What's a large monoculture?
Well, when you're looking off to the side of the road and you see acres and acres of corn or soybeans, mm-hmm. That is a large monoculture, where it's one species of crop that's grown on thousands and thousands of acres. As an example, 5% of the terrestrial land surface of our country, of the United States, is corn. 5%. That's quite a footprint, right? That's a monoculture.
And what's the reason for that? There must be a benefit, an economic benefit?
I think that there are perceived benefits, but it's also a short-term kind of a view. If you're thinking about the long-term food security of our country, then we really need to be thinking about diversity, right? Mm-hmm. There's not an economist in the world that says, put all your eggs in one basket. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. But that's what a lot of times we're doing with our food production system. And so what we're trying to say is not that corn and soybeans are bad, but that we don't have to invest as much of our cropland into these crops as we currently do. And that if we diversify out, that we can actually solve the bee problem as well as many other issues that we're facing in this country.
Well, what's at stake if we don't solve the bee problem? What happens next? What's the impact of continued loss of honeybees?
Well, I think this year we'll be starting to see higher almond prices because we couldn't make all of the almond pollination contracts out in California this year. But that's just the tip of the iceberg, okay? Mm-hmm. Because much of our food production system is reliant on honeybees for pollination services. We need these bees in order to eat the way that we want to eat, and we eat healthy foods. But the other important thing to recognize is that the bees are the canaries in the coal mine. This is not just a bee problem that we're facing right now. This is a biodiversity problem. We're losing birds. We're losing butterflies. We're losing wetland habitats. We're losing prairie. And all of this is inherently tied to how it is that we're producing food.
So how much do, and I'm asking this because I really don't understand, how much do humans have to do with pollination? I mean, I think of bees, and I think of them sort of in a natural environment, and you're talking about beekeepers. So what's the balance between pollination and human interaction with pollination?
Well, I mean, if you go into the grocery store and walk down your fruit and vegetable aisle, almost all of those foods that you're seeing there are directly reliant on the honeybee. And so there is a direct connection in that respect. But a lot of the plants that are in the environment rely on pollination as well. I mean, if we lose the bees, we lose the plants, and humans are not far behind.
So what I'm asking, though, is about honeybee producers, for lack of a better word. I don't know what hive keepers, beekeepers. Mm-hmm. How much of is the food when I walk down the grocery store aisle a result of those humans?
A tremendous amount.
Okay.
So the beekeepers are the ones who are managing the hives that we are currently require in order to produce the foods that we like to eat. So without these beekeepers, and there has been, along with the die-off of the bees, we've lost an awful lot of our beekeepers as well. And that's another really central discussion point in this whole issue, too.
What kind of
how
story
are we going to fill those ranks? where's the next generation of beekeepers going to come from?
The next generation of beekeepers. What are you hearing from beekeepers now? What sort of stories are they telling you? What kind of concerns do they have?
I think that number one is they are extremely concerned about the incredible losses they've been experiencing on an annual basis. Number two, I think that there's also a lot of politics involved in this whole issue. And so good science is sometimes being suppressed on certain key aspects of what's probably affecting the honeybees, especially when it challenges large monoculture agriculture. It's because there's just so much momentum behind this. So the beekeepers are extremely concerned about that as well. Good science and good answers to their questions and a quick response, because time is of the essence right now.
Do you think that science already exists when you say the word suppressed, or is there more research and science investigation that needs to happen to really find out how to move forward?
A little bit of both. I think on one hand, there is good science that is being suppressed. And then on the other hand, there's also scientists that are afraid to ask certain questions on pollinator issues, simply because it's not a way to advance your career is to step into a big old quagmire of political strong opinions in terms of these issues. So
talk about going forward and sort of leading food production innovation. Is that going to come from scientists? Is it going to come from farmers and producers?
Right now, the innovation, there's a movement in this country, and it's called regenerative farming. It's not organic. But it's also not large monoculture either. I mean, we can produce the same crops that we're producing, but when we start to focus on soil health, going no-till, incorporating vegetation like cover crops into food production systems, we're quickly realizing that farmers can be so much more profitable. And while preserving the natural resource base that we require.
You said regenerative farming. Is that fairly new, or is that something that's been around for a while and I'm just hearing about now?
That's a great, I think the term is fairly new. It's what it is sustainable agriculture used to be a buzzword, right? But right now we've depleted our resource base to the point where sustaining a broken system isn't going to be good enough to where we've got to go anymore. Mm-hmm. So now we need to be thinking about how to regenerate some of these resources that we have. And the farmers are leading the science in this issue.
Right.
That's one of the reasons why I got out of why I decided to go this route was to use grassroots efforts to try to use cutting-edge science to support the most innovative farmers in this country who are doing some amazing things. They're eliminating their fertilizer needs and their pesticide needs, and they are making money hand over fist. It's just so exciting to see.
You've written about farmers as citizen scientists. Explain that to me.
Farmers are an incredible tool that that we can use to start solving some of these issues. So when farmers are really doing creative things on their farm, taking what's so special about that farm and putting it onto a research farm loses what's unique and special. And so we need to be actually doing on-farm research and studying this from a systems level with the most innovative producers in the country. Let them decide the questions that we need to be answering to continue to innovate our food production systems.
What kind of traction is regenerative farming getting in South Dakota?
I think that it's still small, but I think that it's growing very rapidly. And we can use various metrics to try to assess that. For example, I was just down in southern Nebraska at Green Cover Seed, which is one of the country's largest cover crop seed producers. Their sales are up by 40% this year. And you look at attendance at meetings, like at Dwayne Beck's Dakota Lakes Research Farm, and farmers are incredibly interested in doing something unique and special.
What are some of the obstacles to sort of pursuing that area while still being financially viable on the farm in South Dakota?
The financial viability of the farming is actually not an obstacle, because regenerative farming is probably more profitable than $3 or $3.10 corn and losing money on that on an annual basis. Obstacles are the coffee shop. Going in and peer pressure there's a real fear or a risk aversion within farmers. And I think that this is understandable. I mean, you don't want to be the first one to try something wacky and then see it fail, right? So we need to really be providing a support network for these guys who really want to try something innovative and make sure that they are absolutely successful. When you do that, and we start planting these really innovative farmers back into their communities, everybody that's driving by that farm is going to be looking and watching. Huh. And when they see new trucks and new grain bins and new houses going up on these really profitable regenerative systems, that's going to be when they start to really make some change.
What's it look like other than the new trucks and the new equipment? What's the farmland look like? I'm thinking of diverse crops. You've mentioned that. What else?
Color is in the environment. I want Brookings and Dual County airplanes to look down from on high and like be like, what the hell are all those flowers doing down there? I mean, the counties are like purple, for crying out loud. We're trying to diversify our cropping base to provide things or crops that have high value seeds to support, you know, further innovation in terms of cover cropping and conservation strips while feeding the bees. So we're stacking these enterprises. Rather than relying on just one crop or a couple of crops within our agricultural system, we're diversifying out the revenue streams that are coming into that and stacking these enterprises in so that not only are you taking a seed crop value off of that land, but you're also taking honey or livestock production off of that land as well. That's how these farmers are becoming so profitable while growing their soil. It's so exciting.
So take me back to that coffee shop and someone says you're kind of wacky, and how do you overcome that initial doubt? What do you say in the coffee shop to the group of people who are sitting there saying, I don't know?
Come and see it. Seeing is believing. Seeing is believing. So that's why these the Blue Dasher Farm Initiative, one of the things that we're trying to do is establish a national network and centers for excellence in regenerative farming so that we are tying our success to the profitability of these small farms that we're developing. So demonstration and seeing what's going on out there is going to be really key in that.
All right. Tell us where you find out more, or how do you find out about the gathering on Monday, June 13th?
Well, go to www.bluedasher.farm to learn a little bit more about what we're doing. That's www.bluedasher.farm. And then you can search online for Keep the Hives Alive Tour. Otherwise, we will see you, I hope, at 5:30 p.m. on Monday at our farm. We're going to have a catered supper and have some great speakers talking about agriculture as the solution.
Dr. John Lundgren, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.